Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Brian Castle, the founder of Audience Ops and Ops Calendar, author and a fellow podcaster, and we're going to talk about validating a SaaS business today. This episode is brought to you by Balsamiq. They just came up with a new web app called Balsamiq Cloud. It's the best tool for fast, approachable, collaborative wireframing. You can capture ideas, collaborate on designs, and get everyone on board. Check it out for yourself. Try it free for 30 days at balsamiq.cloud. Hi, Bran.
Hey, Jane. Great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for making the time. How about we start with a short blitz questionnaire so that we can learn about yourself more?
Sure.
Question number one is, what do you do for a living?
That is the toughest question to answer. I kind of run my own business these days. I guess by trade or my background, I come from a background as a designer, front-end web designer, web developer. That's kind of how I started out my self-employed career, which is, almost 10 years ago now? Wow. So I did that for a few years, just kind of typical web design consulting. But today, since then, I've made the transition into building a few different businesses. But as you said, today I run a productized content marketing service called Audience Ops, where we have a remote team who basically we run the blogs for a number of clients. And then kind of related to that or kind of born out of that, it was our SaaS product called Ops Calendar, which is a content calendar tool that helps you plan and execute and produce any sort of recurring content, whether that's a blog, blog articles or podcast episodes, videos, webinars, anything that has like a recurring process. You can collaborate with your team in there, but it also kind of folds in some analytics so you can, track and report on how each individual piece of content is performing. And it's got some social media stuff thrown in there too. And then, aside from all that, I like to podcast and write about entrepreneurship, about productized services, bootstrapping, self-funding, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm enjoying your website very much. You're one of those people who publish very, very, detailed articles and have spectacular lead magnets in the end of them, usually.
Yeah, I try to. I've been trying to make them like shorter and more. I think I just kind of ramble on too much these days, but I'm working on that.
Awesome. Question number two is, how did you get there? But you kind of shared the last 10 years off of the story. But maybe what happened before that? Maybe how did you grow up? Or what kind of education did you have?
Sure. So all the way back, I guess I grew up pretty typical, middle class here in the United States. I grew up in Long Island, New York, which is about, I lived about 45 minutes east of New York City for most of my young life. And then I always thought I was going to get into music. That was kind of like a big, it still is, but I don't really have much time for it these days. But I thought early on, I was really into, playing in bands and stuff. And then I actually went into college specializing and majoring in audio production and music production. And I thought,
oh, wow.
I really wanted to get into a career in that, working in recording studios and producing music and then even specifically getting into kind of composing and producing music for picture, like music for film, music for TV, that kind of stuff. I actually did a bit of that work in my early 20s, and which was cool because it was like it's very similar to web work because it's kind of that cross between being really creative but also technology and working with computers and that kind of stuff. I did dabble in that early on, but then I quickly realized that jobs in the music industry that don't pay $0 a week are pretty hard to come by. So That's when I kind of pivoted into my backup interest, if you will, which was web design. And I always kind of, you know, the typical like hacking basic HTML, you know, early on working with like GeoCities and stuff. That kind of got me interested in that. Oh, yeah.
I remember GeoCities. I had a site on that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So you know, soon after I left college, I got an internship at a web design agency in Manhattan, New York City, and then became full-time employed there for about 3 years. So I was doing mostly front-end development, a little bit of like project management there. And then after that, that's when I decided to, I was still in kind of my early mid-20s when I decided to go freelance. I didn't even realize up until then that like freelancing or being self-employed was even a possibility. Like I wasn't aware that that whole life existed until I worked at the agency, and I realized that agency also hired freelancers sometimes. So I was like, oh, those people basically do what I do, but they kind of come in for a day here, a day there, and they work for other clients too. That seems interesting. So I kind of started Googling around, and I found a few blogs about freelancing. And then I was like, you know what? I'm young. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I don't have a mortgage. You know, if I'm going to kind of dive in and do this, now would be a good time. And that was January of 2008. And so I'm really glad that I did make that move at that moment, because later that year, about 9 or 10 months later, the entire global economy crashed, I was able to make it through as a freelancer at that time, which was good. It was actually like a lot of companies were hiring freelancers instead of hiring full-time employees, you know, when the crash happened. And I think that had I not left the job before that, if I was able to hold on to the job, I probably would have kept the job through the recession and then maybe had never left after that. So I'm glad that I did, you know, make that jump pretty early on.
Yeah, I remember those times too. They laid off like half of our agency back then. I was the one who was left, but I really survived also due to freelancing. We have a lot of common.
Yeah, totally.
Can you please give a brief recap of things that you had before this wonderful streamlined lineup of things? Now, you had a restaurant engine, right? You had a book about design. Maybe something else?
So I had, let's see. So I was doing the freelance design work, and then my very first, I'd say, digital product was called Theme Jam. So that's a WordPress themes shop. And I held on to that and ran it from I guess I started that around 2009 or 2010. And then I held it on as like a little side project up until 2015. And I sold the site to somebody in Founder Cafe. But basically that was kind of a cool side project, because it was the very first time that I was able to design a custom WordPress theme and sell it for like $59. At the time I was, you know, back in like 2009, I got really excited when I first came across, Woo Themes and what AD and his team were doing there, and what Jason Schuler was doing at Press 75, and, you know, what Corey Miller was doing at iThemes. You know, those guys were kind of like the pioneers of the WordPress themes market. And I was like, wow, like I know WordPress. I design sites. Like I can't believe even selling digital templates like that is even a possibility. So that got me really excited, and I had a bunch of, you know, late nights, and I, you know, came up with a few themes. And then selling that very first theme, like, you know, day two after launching it, I didn't expect anybody to buy these things, and then, you know, a few people did. That was really, really exciting. And then that also grew, like, I think that year later I also created like a WordPress theme for doing project proposals, and that kind of went along with Theme Jam. But that, you know, then that just kind of like, you know, puttered along as like a little side income, not very much. And then that whole market got very, very competitive, and I got focused on other things. So it just remained a side project until I let it go. Other than that, there were a few little ventures, a few little projects that just never got off the ground. My friend Brad Tunar and I, he and I today, we run a thing called Big Snow Tiny Conf every year, which is like a small conference ski snowboard get together every January. But years ago, like back in 2011, he and I wanted to start something together. Like, how do you explain it? I guess it was like a way for freelancers to pass on overflow work to each other and kind of get referrals for them. So we kind of came up with this concept and designed some things, and we didn't really know anything about launching products back then, and it just never went anywhere. We didn't even launch anything. So little ideas like that just kind of came and went. But then, and then the next thing, and it was like 2011 when I started to work on Restaurant Engine, basically.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about that.
So I, again, I was kind of making a, you know, like a comfortable enough living as a freelance designer, dabbled in a few products here and there, but nothing ever very significant. And then 2011, at that point, I started to really get interested in like SaaS and startups, and I was listening to a lot of like Mixergy, and I was listening to I was starting to really tune into software startups and getting more interested in that. So I was like, you know, I would love to build my own SaaS. And what do I know? I know web design, I know WordPress, and it would be really nice to be able to, The problem that I saw was that the process of launching a WordPress site is really, it's actually pretty technical. I mean, a lot of us listening to this podcast, it's like super simple. Like, we don't even think about it. We could fire up a WordPress site, no problem. But for most people, like, even if you know how to use a web browser, like the whole idea of like getting a web host, getting a domain, installing WordPress, installing a bunch of themes and plugins, configuring them, you know, pointing your DNS, making updates to your website, like all those things are really complicated and difficult to do, if not impossible, if you're, you know, say a restaurant owner or a lawyer or a small business owner. And so I was thinking, like, that's got to be easier. We've got to have like a streamlined, like all-in-one hosted solution. And there were those things available, like, you know, WordPress.com basically does this, but I was thinking, like, for a niche, like, to in order to make it really easy to scale, then all of the websites would need to have the same feature set. So how do you make all the same feature set without, you know, bloating and having a thousand different options? You basically focus on one niche vertical, like restaurants, because they all need menus, they all need photos, they all need hours and locations, like they all need the same set of features on their website, so it can become very much template and easy to duplicate. So that was the idea. I made a list of like 20 different niche verticals and then just kind of randomly chose restaurants to focus on. And then started to build that out. And then I made a thousand other mistakes while building it, but eventually after spending a lot of time and effort, I got like a few paying customers.
Right. The reason why I'm asking about your early ventures is so that when we talk about your latest SaaS, people don't get an impression that it's like a momentary success. It definitely looks like you have dabbled and worked for years in order to have a good understanding of the industry.
Absolutely true. And I think that is the case for anybody that you see launching anything. Like if you, anyone listening to this, if you see somebody launching a SaaS product, like you've heard about it somewhere, that means that, you know, just the fact that they've been able to get that out there, like coverage somewhere of the news, you know, think about all the things that they launched that nobody ever heard about. You know, everyone has them.
Yeah, definitely. These days, what does your typical day look like?
Well, it's, you know, today I work mostly from my home office here in our house. We live in Orange, Connecticut now, which is kind of the, we're still about an hour outside of New York City, but now I'm like on the north side of the city. So I've got a young 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So around 7:30 a.m., I'm with them, you know, doing the breakfast thing and hanging out. And then by probably around 8:30 a.m., I'm getting in here to work. I try to do a lot of, almost all of my real productive work happens in the morning between like 8:30 and lunchtime. That's when I find that I just work so, I'm just so much more productive. I have like 10 times the productivity that I'd have later in the day. So I try to do a lot of creative work, any sort of writing or designing or working on stuff in the morning. Afternoons late morning into the afternoons tends to be when I try to do any sort of calls or interviews or meetings. I don't have a ton of meetings. Like with my team, I really keep them to a minimum. We do most of our meetings kind of slowly through Slack and through email and Trello and stuff like that. But I'll do some like sales calls. I'll do some interviews and things in the afternoons. When I'm really working hard, I tend to work up until like 5:30, 6 o'clock, you know, for dinner time. But I've been trying to make an effort in the last year or two to kind of stop working by around 4:30 p.m. if I can. That way I can spend more time with the family or get some exercise in and then night times I'm just hanging out, watching TV, typical stuff.
Awesome. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I really love working at home, you know, especially with young kids around and the comfort of a really nice home office. We moved to this new house about a year ago and one of the key things, I renovated this whole office to be like the most ideal working situation. I really love that. And like yesterday, I was able to go to my daughter's Halloween parade at her school in the middle of the day on a Wednesday, on a Tuesday, you know. I love that sort of stuff. I love to travel. And we can basically just like get up and go anywhere, anytime. I mean, that's an advantage of having kids who are not old enough for real school yet. But just having that flexibility is really awesome. I guess that's kind of like the best thing. The other thing that I love over the last few years is just having built up like teams and systems and processes. Being able to take off work and go somewhere or take a day off, and I know that the business is still functioning. It's still producing and generating revenue. Whereas a few years ago, when I was just a freelancer, you know, if I'm taking a day off, I'm basically not getting paid that day. It's nice to have some more stability now.
Great, absolutely. What about the least?
I guess I'd have to say the stress and the emotional roller coaster of running a business that never seems to end. My friend Jordan and I, who I do the podcast with, we are always talking about this. It's like, It's sad but true that my emotional level goes directly in line with like my MRR level.
Oh,
as it goes up, I'm feeling good. As it goes down, yeah, it's not such a good day. It's tricky. I guess you get used to it, I guess it gets better over time. But it doesn't go away.
Absolutely. I just finished reading Shoe Dog, a book by the founder of Nike. And, you know, like 50 years ago in the shoe industry, it was absolutely the same. You know, just daily fighting different kinds of problems, including cash flow and primarily cash flow.
Absolutely. Yep.
What is your next big thing? I guess I know the answer.
Yeah, this past year I've been really pretty focused on Ops Calendar, the SaaS product, and that's been very much a slow build and getting traction, and we still have a lot further to go on it. It's nowhere near where I want it to be, and I would have wanted to be here much faster. So that's just, you know, an ongoing kind of effort, but everything that I do is self-funded, and that means my approach to that has been to work on a few different things simultaneously, which is tough, but I think that's kind of the way that I've chosen to sustain and self-fund everything. Whereas if I were a startup who had investors and I had a lot of cash in the bank or something, then I can literally spend 100% of my time and effort on one startup. But in order to self-sustain it, I need other things going, which is basically, you know, running audience ops. That's largely running on its own with the team and whatnot. But then the other thing that I do that's kind of a significant part of my business is productize the course. And that's all me, and it's all through my personal content and there's a bit of coaching and kind of a mastermind group that goes with that. And that's been that continues to resonate with my audience. I launched it back in 2014, and today it's still going. And I actually just began working on a complete overhaul of that course that I'm hoping to get out there in like early 2018. So I'm definitely thinking about actually a bunch of like rebranding stuff on my personal site to support the productize course and kind of adding a membership component to that. So I'm starting to think through those things and get the pieces together for like January, February, 2018.
Oh, wonderful. It's a great course. It's really rich in content and gives people great guidance in terms of productized consulting. You've been like cruising around with different talks in different conferences about productized services and consulting.
Yeah, I just really, I really like that model. I mean, obviously, because I've run like two businesses using that model. But what I really love about it, and what's been the case for me, is that it's been that bridge between, you know, freelancing and then building what I think is like a real business, like a product business, but just a business in general that can scale and grow in value. That's not just based on your own time, and so. It's not just the productized service itself, like that business, like Audience Ops has grown to a team, like a team of 20 people, and it continues to run. You know, Restaurant Engine was a business that, you know, leveraging the productized service model, it actually got up to a point where not only ran itself, I was able to sell it to another owner and they took it over. But it's also that bridge to like open the door to new product ideas, like Ops Calendar never would have. The idea for it never would have come about had I not, you know, worked on Audience Ops for a year or two. So I just really like how it can lead into things like that.
Right. Going back to the main topic, about a year ago, when you were starting out, I think it's more than a year, actually, you did a sequence of very sensible steps about validating your product, and you also wrote a great article about that. I'm going to link to the show notes. I would love to hear what you did back then, and then I'm going to ask you what actually changed and what would you have done differently. If you did it today, yeah.
Yeah, good question. So I did write out all the details in that post, and I wrote it, I guess, around a year ago. So it was much fresher in my mind then than it is now. But yeah, I mean, like what I can, you know, definitely this time around, this was not my first rodeo. You know, as we talked about, I've done other products, and so I knew very much. First of all, I knew how long and slow it would be to launch any sort of SaaS application. And I knew how much it would cost. Like, I'm not a developer. I do front-end development, but I can't build an application myself. And I knew that in order to hire even one developer or a couple of developers, over a span of many months in order to build a product like this, I mean, we're talking a serious amount of cash investment. So I knew early on I had to validate this and make sure that it's actually worth that time and investment before I even spend much, if any, money on it. So I guess my thinking early on was like, okay, I know that I want to launch a SaaS product. I do see a need in content production because we see it every day in Audience Ops. Like we've been using a combination of different tools like Trello and Google Docs and WordPress and spreadsheets and stuff like that. And there are definitely kind of holes in the process. Oh, and like Buffer and social media scheduling. where like we can get the job done using very detailed written procedures as I've built in my business, but there's still a lot of room to automate and string things together in a much streamlined and automated way, and everything kind of centers around the calendar. That's been kind of like the missing piece that we identified in like Trello or in spreadsheets. You know, seeing everything in a calendar view with recurring processes that happen on the same way every week, week in, week out. Then like scheduling social media on the calendar based on the publishing of your content, you know, things like that. Like in Buffer, we would schedule things, but then if the blog article was pushed back by a week, then we have tweets that might go out with broken links, you know. So just like a lot of little things like that. If we only had a very integrated, seamless calendar, it would make everything a lot easier. So that was kind of the original conception of the idea. And then in terms of validating it, I wanted to do a few things. My very first step was to just kind of mock up some very basic wireframes and then show them to friends. I think I emailed something like 30 people that I know and trust who run their own products and just got their initial impressions of it. And then the other thing that I wanted to do was run it by my audience, which is a larger group of people. But then the other thing that I did want to incorporate into this whole validation process was to get it in front of strangers, people who have never heard of me, never heard of Audience Ops, you know, because I know that like you're always going to get kind of like biased information from people that know you, you know, like overly supportive feedback from people that know you, even if they're being like helpful and constructive. You know, I'm not actually proving that people will that we could sell it to strangers, basically, unless I get some feedback from those folks too.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to incorporate all those pieces into the validation process.
How did you go around finding those strangers and reaching out cold to them?
I did a few things. One was I went onto Twitter and I searched. I used like Twitter search to see people who are tweeting and asking questions about content calendar tools, editorial calendar tools. And that's also something that I was validating too, like not like just how easy will it be to find people online who are talking about this problem, right? Even if there is a problem in the market, if people aren't actively out there searching for answers and talking about it, and asking questions about it, they're just going to be harder to reach. So I wanted to make sure that I was going into a market where people are easy to reach online. That was definitely something in Restaurant Engine that was not very easy. You know, there are of course there are millions of restaurants in the world, but you can't just go onto any forum or Twitter or Facebook and find people asking about that and then get in touch with them and expect them to respond to you.
Yeah, a forum for restaurant founders that probably doesn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but with this, you know, I found plenty of marketers and agency people and people who are marketers who work at SaaS products and just any sort of product that does content. There are a lot of people talking about and asking about content calendars. So I found that, and I found just, I don't know, 20 or so people right off the bat, just right on Twitter. And I'm a total stranger. I would like tweet to them and say, hey, you know, you asked about editorial calendars. I forgot exactly what I said. I probably said something like, we're building one, or we're building some automation to solve that problem. Can I pick your brain about it? And so I would send out, I think I responded to like 20 random tweets, and I think I got maybe 4 responses that then turned into, you know, email conversations, in some cases phone conversations. And then I also did the same thing in Facebook. I would go into Facebook groups, you know, like marketing groups, startup groups, software groups, and I would search the groups for any conversations about the same thing, like content calendars, editorial calendars, social media scheduling, and I would just private DM them through Facebook and then start those conversations. And, you know, these are total strangers, so they're going to be colder than people that know me, you know, much lower response rate. But I did see a few people who got really excited when I started talking about this idea and then showing them some basic screenshots. I think I might have had like a landing page up at that point. And then I remember one or two guys, I got into these like long, detailed email conversations where I was like asking a question and showing them something. And then the guy wrote back like five paragraphs of like, oh, we do this, this, and this. And we're really, really frustrated with this tool. And if it only did this and that. And like, though, that's just gold to me. You know, that's just like, all right, something is here. People are frustrated. You know, that looks good.
Absolutely. And we are talking about two parts of that. One is actual passive research, you know, squaring the forums, Quora, other resources for what we call sales safari, right? Finding customer pains. And the other is actually actively reaching out to those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and you do it enough times, you know, you reach out to enough people, you start to see patterns in their responses, you know, like they start to mention the same competitor over and over again, or they start to mention the same need or the same frustration. And yeah.
Tell us a bit how you did the pre-orders when you haven't actually built anything, but you were already collecting money.
Yeah. So, I'm just trying to think back to the sequence of events. I was doing that sort of like outreach on social media. When I sent my entire list, the like, hey, check out this coming soon page for, I don't think I was even calling it Ops Calendar at the time. I might've been calling it like Audience Ops Platform or something like that. Eventually I started to shift to focus more on the calendar aspect. And then I had this landing page with a form that said like request more information. And it wasn't just like a one sentence landing page. It was actually like, I think I had like five sections with like screenshots, headlines, descriptions of like the five key benefits and like features and benefits basically.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't super detailed. I remember some of those things were just like animated GIFs and like really like scribbled like wireframe kind of ideas. But it just kind of gets across the concept, you know, and then enter your email address to get on the early access list for this. And then that leads to a survey, which is like 10 questions long, where I'm asking them more specific questions like, what are you doing right now for content? What's really frustrating? What are some tools that you've tried? What, based on what you've seen so far of this tool, what makes you interested in it? And I think I had some like, here's some preliminary pricing information. What are your thoughts on these price points? So these are questions in a form, which takes more time for them to fill out. But they've already entered their email address. So, you know, I'm trying to get as much information as I can. And so I sent that whole landing page to my list, you know, several thousand people. And that got a few hundred people to go through the first email opt-in, and then probably about 100 people early on filled out that survey on the back end. And then out of those, you know, I took a lot of time, like days, to just sift through and read every single word of every survey response. And then I'm starting to, you know, form patterns and see where the interest is. And then the people who are like the most interested, I personally invited to a phone call. And that was maybe 30 people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like 30 survey responses I personally invited to a phone call. And then, I can't remember exactly. I think I might have had like an initial call with them, and then I came back to them a few weeks later, and I said, "Hey, so you know, the idea is coming further along. I have like more mock-ups at this point. I want to invite you to a second phone call, and I'm going to present to you where the idea is at, what the plan is, and if you're interested, I'm going to ask you to pre-purchase a spot in the early access program." So I presented that via email. And then here's my calendar to book a time. And then I like I think I sent that email to 20 people, and then I booked like 15 phone calls, or maybe I had like the 20 phone calls, but 14 of those ended up paying. And on the call, what happened was I had like a pretty short like slide presentation that I prepared that I'm just giving to these people one on one. You know, here is the problem as I understand it. These are the key benefits of the tool that we're building. Here is, and then I kind of walk through some of the mockups and how it's going to work, some of the key features. These are what the price points are going to be, or an idea for what they're going to be, you know, once the whole thing launches to the public. And here is my projected roadmap of like, in the first 3 months, we're going to get to this point. After 6 months, it should be here, and so on. And then I'm inviting you to be an early access participant. I'm asking for $200 today to, you know, to join this program. My expectation is that within 3 to 6 months, we'll have a very early beta version of the product for you to use. I invited them into a Slack community as well. And then right there on the call, I'd ask them to kind of make a decision whether they want to join or not. And, you know, 14 people did.
Was it a lifetime license, or how did you convert that to actual monthly revenue later?
Oh, yeah. So the deal was, it was free access once it becomes like the very first version. The very first usable version will be free for them to use. And from the day that they paid the $200, that first version won't be ready for like another 5 months because we hadn't even coded anything mm-hmm. yet. And it's kind of a more complex product, not super simple to build very quickly. I think we ended up building it in around 3 or 4 months, the first version. But then they started using it for free, and then I told them that, like 5 months after that, we would get to a point where the product is ready for me to launch to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And then that early group will get an additional free 3 months of using the product.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, they'll get a lifetime 30% discount if they want to continue on a paid plan.
Yeah, wonderful.
So good. Like essentially they got like kind of like 6 months free of free use, and then after that they lock in like a lifetime discount.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I stepped on that problem with Tiny Reminder. I sold about 11 lifetime licenses for $99, approximately. I don't remember exact numbers of users. But not all of those who paid actually got to using the product. Actually, a little bit more than half. And the other people just, you know, went on with their business.
Yeah. That I've noticed the same thing with Ops Calendar. So now, like, here we are, like a year later, and it's, you know, I probably made a few mistakes in this process myself, but I was surprised to see that. Okay, so out of the 14 people who have prepaid, I think today maybe 5 of them are paying customers.
Right.
Of Ops Calendar.
That's a good result, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I think like 4 are paying customers, and we have a few other new paying customers in there. But I think some of them just got busy, you know, they're just focused on other things. But I think some of them in that group just, they kind of had an interest or a need early on, but it wasn't a burning problem for them. They were just more interested in kind of like seeing behind the scenes the development of this new product. Mm-hmm. I think some people kind of fell into that group. I think the other kind of... I don't think this would have prevented me from moving forward. I mean, it didn't, but everybody in that 14 people, the people who filled out the survey and then bought, they were all from my personal audience, like people who've known me for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I had some really promising conversations with complete strangers, none of the strangers were the early paying prepaid customers. So I don't know if that would have turned them, that would have meant they would have been more engaged if they were like strangers and then involved, but I don't know.
I guess it's just a natural conversion rate because people are impulse buyers, and I'm also among those because probably I don't mind paying, you know, $200 for a really promising product, but the situation might totally change a few months down the road. In my business, just in my mood, I might continue using Trello or whatever not.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for a lot of them, it's like, even still today, some of them are like might still be waiting for the product to come further along where it can fully replace a couple of tools that they've been using. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we're at right now. Like, I think we're, in terms of like the feature roadmap, we're probably like 60 or 70% of the way there. And I want to go another 20% where we're really covering all these kind of key functionalities that other tools provide that where Ops Calendar can kind of come in and replace. I think we're getting closer there now, finally.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember Paul Jarvis with his Of Course books a couple of years ago. He just had such gorgeous design, and he was selling lifetime licenses for $200, and I was almost jumping in just because it looked so great and sounded like such a deal, you know.
Right,
while
right.
It was really not the audience at all, maybe just tangentially.
Yeah, you know, I mean, locking in a lifetime discount is a nice thing, because that's something that, I mean, I don't plan to ever really offer that, and most companies don't offer that except in an early beta kind of situation. So,
what you do is actually very smart, because you don't want to, you know, for them to take advantage of your early stage forever. Probably 6 months or 1 year is definitely enough for a good pre-order.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, they'll be so resource heavy that I don't want to give them free access. It's really just more, I want to validate that like people are going to want to at some point commit to paying monthly for this tool. And if you kind of come on board today with that understanding that at some point it won't be free, then there's that mentality of like, okay, these people are willing to join or not.
Yeah. And just to remind everyone, saying that you're willing to join and paying with your credit card are two different stories.
That's very true, too. Yeah.
It's very well known in our circles, but maybe people who are starting out might make this, you know, deceptive mistakes. Please don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you did so many great things that informed your feature scope, you know, informed your product development, informed I bet you got a lot of material for your sales copy too from those wording.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely in terms of prioritizing features. Because this product, as I've talked about, like does a bunch of different things. Like it's all related to the calendar, but it does like social scheduling, it does WordPress syncing, it does Google Analytics integration, it does, you know, checklists, like automated checklists with deadlines and assigning teammates. And
crazy, crazy scope.
Yeah. Yeah. So like it's a crazy scope. And so just figuring out like which of those features are most important for users so that I can prioritize them and build them first. But while also balancing it with audience ops, like we're now using it for all of our clients in audience ops, and we're building features that we need to use for our process in audience ops. So I know that like once it gets to a point where it's like kind of completely running the show at audience ops, then I know that other agencies who do this sort of thing will get just as much value out of it. And that's kind of, I'm trying to like close that gap now, like this month, basically.
At what point did you consider the thing, your idea validated, so to speak, the actual term validation? What did it mean for you in your process?
I think I talked about this in the article, but I think of validation not as like a binary thing, but like degrees. So,
mm-hmm.
It starts from zero, and then it goes like you just get 10% more confident, 10% more confident, 10% more confident. You know, it doesn't go like yes or no. You know, but I know that like early on. So there are like all these little hurdles, right? Like very early on, it was like, okay, what do my friends think about it? And they kind of give me mixed reviews because they're Some of them are not the target customers. Some of them are just trying to be overly critical in a supportive way. And then it's like, okay, what does my audience think about it? Getting good feedback, that makes me more confident. And then can I reach strangers at all? Or can I find strangers? That makes me more confident. What do they say about it? More confident. And then will people actually join a call with me? A little bit more confident. Will people pay for it? And my thinking was, if I can get 10 people to prepay $200, then that will be the go ahead for me to go ahead and hire developers. And when I got 14 people, I was like, okay, so that now I'm good to go. I will go ahead and hire the developers. But I still don't think it's even fully validated at that point, and maybe not even today, you know, because so then, like, you know, moving forward, since then we've been able to get a few strangers to just come to the site through Google search, or they heard about it somewhere and they signed up as paying customers. So that makes me even more confident now. And then some of the demo calls that I've had with customers recently, where it's like a founder plus their marketer, and the marketer is looking at it and giving me feedback like, oh, that's the tool that I've been missing in my workflow. You know,
awesome.
You know, again, like it's good feedback, but it's not, I don't consider it 100% validated, because there are still a lot of open questions, right? Like, we only have a handful of paying customers. It's nowhere near profitable yet. I don't have any like high volume marketing channels that are working yet. Like, you know, just stuff coming from my audience, but I don't have like, you know, funnels or traffic channels that are bringing in tons of leads every month. So I still need to kind of prove those out and get those figured out. But I think it's pointing in the right direction. It's just that it's a very slow process.
I would like to mention that actually getting pre-orders, for example, it's totally necessary. But as you mentioned, it does not guarantee you success, really, judging by my own experience. It does not guarantee product market fit. However, I would be even more suspicious to move forward without it, because then it's just zero validation.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I mean, I've seen a couple of products recently that are kind of similar to what I've been doing, in that they came from like a service business and then they turned their service into more of a SaaS product. And the SaaS is a totally free product. And then the idea is like they're going to build it and get all these free users and then present the paid plans to try to, you know, get their first paying customers that way. And I'm not against freemium by any means. It's something that I've considered, but I think early on I do want to validate that people at least mentally can commit to, okay, this will be a paid tool and I'm in for it.
Yeah. Especially for, you know, business to business app, it is totally possible to pay some kind of money when you start using it. Really, yeah. As someone who did freemium, I do not recommend it. We had a great episode here with Bridget Harris. I'm going to link to it in the show notes, where we discuss the freemium model. It's not as easy, and it really postpones that revenue. You know, any kind of revenue, it might be easier to gain traction, but the monetization is really postponed.
You know, I've always had that same view myself, but I'm just recently kind of starting to change a little bit, I think, because...
Until you try.
yeah, exactly. So I have not really tried it, but I think even with a paid plan on SaaS, it's still such a long, slow ramp before that SaaS business is actually a viable revenue stream that can like support, you know, you and your family and your business. Like, it's, you have to have some other source. I mean, think like in terms of years of income source to sustain the development and launch and traction of a SaaS product, a $49, $99 a month SaaS, like you still need hundreds of customers before it's a significant business. So, and I mean, that's why I've been so adamant about productized services, right? Like that's funding everything that I'm doing. That's what gives me the freedom to be able to work on it. And so I'm starting to think that since the paid model is takes so long anyway. You know, maybe why not have a freemium plan just to get more users in there? Like, if it makes sense for your product, you know, have a free plan that can be kind of like a marketing funnel to get into the paid channel as well. There are so many conditions of like whether it may or may not work for your product in your market, but I think the argument, like I'm starting to think now that the argument of, okay, don't do freemium because you need your app to make money faster to support your business, like it's gonna go slow no matter what. So like that's kind of my thinking.
Yeah, it should be, you know, on the wallpaper of every founder that is gonna take like years before anything good could happen. Even though everyone starting out has hope that it's gonna spiral fast, but it's probably going to not spiral fast.
And I honestly, I think that needs to be talked about more because that is the reality. I think most SaaS founders, especially self-funded bootstrap SaaS founders, will tell you that, you know, whether it's been talked about or not.
Yeah, not just SaaS. I mean, product dollars for the books, for example, are also very hard earned. They're very hard to make. Much harder than, you know, it seems that publish your own book is a get rich quick scheme, but it's definitely not.
It can be good in the initial launch if you've built an audience, but then sustaining it over time is tough.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to try to wrap up because we've already been talking for a while. It's a really interesting conversation. A year has passed. Did you have any surprises? What has happened and what would you have done differently in your validation phase if you had to do it again with another product, for example?
I did not expect it to go so slowly in the development of the product. And that's part of, I'd say, just a little bit due to the development speed, like the working with the developers. I expected things to move faster than I had hoped, they moved slower than I had hoped. But more so it was just a matter of cash flow. Everything is self-funded and a few months back, cash flow started to slow down unexpectedly, and that just forced me to slow down development and how much I can pay my developers. I've since been able to ramp that back up, which is good. So now we're moving much faster, but that caused the whole timeline of the product development to kind of double. Like I expected the feature set to be there as it is today, like 6 months ago, but it is what it is.
At the same time, I think it has its benefits to it because first you have time to keep your head cold, and as opposed to if you had funding, you would just build and build and build very fast. But it's so it's so easy to get tired of it because you have all the resources. All you have to have is energy, and humans don't have that much energy to do that all the time, I think, unless you're some crazy kind of founder, and we're just mere humans. Your top, two pieces of advice for people who have an idea and want to take it to market with a SaaS.
Let's see. I think obviously validation so important. Just do any of the steps that I talked about. Like any one of those things will just get you one step closer to gaining a little bit more confidence in that it will be a good idea. I would also say that the other side of that is just do it.
Right,
that goes against probably everything we just talked about in this episode. Mm-hmm. But especially if you're new, like if this is your first thing, just go ahead and build it. And see. I don't necessarily mean sink years of your life into this thing, but don't stress over like, oh, it has to be the perfect product, or I have to get pre-orders in order to move forward, or this and that. Like if you've never built anything before, just build something small, like what you did with Tiny Reminder, or write an ebook and see what it's like to build a digital product that is not services, you know, and I mean, that's what I did years ago with Theme Jam. I was like, I see other people doing it. Let's, who cares if it's validated? I'm just going to spend a couple of all-nighters and build some of my own and see what happens. And you know, you learn and you make mistakes, and that's important.
Especially too. If you're a developer and you don't need like tons of cash to do that.
Totally. If you're a developer, I wish I were you so that I can build like the 10 shiny object ideas that I have in mind without hiring someone.
Right. I would like to chime in with a little other piece of advice, which is pick an existing product category, because I made that mistake. Make sure that your product is well understood by your audience. It's searched, and just, you know, when you say content calendar, we know what it means, editorial calendar. When I say some kind of reminder tool, people have no idea. I have to have like a page long explanation of how it works. So for your first SaaS, it's much better to build something, you know, well known. I don't know, help desk.
That's a really good point.
Like that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, because actually, early on, the very first iteration of Ops Calendar, it was not called that. I was calling it like Audience Ops Platform, and it incorporated a calendar aspect to it, but like plus all these other bloated features. And as I got some feedback, then I started to realize the calendar is the thing that people gravitate to, and that, like you said, like that's what people know. Like they understand a calendar, they look at it, they instantly understand how it works, and that's when I decided to change it to Ops Calendar, and it made so much more sense, and that really helped a lot. And I think these days in SaaS, it is so competitive that like every product category, there are already competitors. That's not to, you know, scare you away from doing it, but you know, it does mean like it. There's nothing wrong with going into a market if there are some competitors. Going into a super crowded market, maybe you want to think twice about that. But if there are three or four or five competitors in there, like go in there and see if you can, you know, build something a little bit unique from those, but still part of the same.
Actually,
category.
Good competition is a sign of validation. They just did it before you did, and they are making money with it. Therefore, you can build something similar and also find people paying for it.
Yep.
I got this advice like a year or more ago from Alex of Jitbit. He was like, build something like a help desk, you know, for your first product. And I totally ignored it. And now here I am saying it in my own voice, because indeed, I do highly recommend human words for your product.
I don't know that tiny reminder is necessarily so unique though. Like, I can't really think of like an exact like competitor really, but it does already align with like just things that freelancers are normally doing, like sending follow-up emails.
Right.
So, you know, just aligning with that, like even with Ops Calendar, I'm just aligning with the fact that you already know what a calendar is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pattern that people already relate to. So, yeah.
Brian, thank you so much for your insight. It was awesome. Where can people find your work and your awesome products online?
Yeah, so, you know, Audience Ops is the content service. Ops Calendar is at opscalendar.com. I'm Cast Jam on Twitter. And yeah, and I co-host Bootstrapped Web, and I do the Productize podcast. And I think you're going to be on an episode of that pretty soon.
Yeah, awesome. And you mentioned you have a discount for our users for the calendar.
Yeah, absolutely. So just mention, you know, Jane's name or the name of this podcast, and you'll get 30. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you so much once again, and have a great day.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.